You're listening to a University of Minnesota Bookstore author event podcast, recorded live from our location in Kauffman Memorial Union on the U of M's Twin Cities campus. For more information on upcoming author events, please visit our website at bookstore.umn.edu.
Our guest today, as you know, is Gary Tobbs. He is a contributing correspondent for Science Magazine and a Robert Wood Johnson Foundation investigator in health policy research at the University of California, Berkeley School of Public Health. His articles about science, medicine, and health have appeared in Discover, The Atlantic, and the New York Times Magazine, among other publications. He has won 3 Science and Society Journalism Awards given by the National Association of Science Writers, and he is the only print journalist to be so recognized, as well as awards from the Pan American Health Organization, the American Institute of Physics, and the American Physical Society. His writing was selected for the Best American Science Writing 2002 and the Best of the Best of American Science Writing and the Best American Science and Nature Writing, 2000 and 2003. He is the author of Good Calories, Bad Calories, Challenging the Conventional Wisdom on Diet, Weight Control, and Disease, and also the author of his newest book, Why We Get Fat. Please join me in welcoming Gary Tobbs.
Thank you very much. I'm gonna be talking fast because I have a lot of ground to cover, and not because I'm trying to sell you anything. And I wanted to thank the University of Minnesota for having me here at the bookstore, because I've tried to get this talk at the University of Minnesota Nutrition Department, and they won't have me. And one reason they won't have me is because I've written a lot about my beliefs that the saturated fat is not dangerous. So anyway, just a little bit of background. I started as a hard science writer. I had actually a physics and engineering degrees, journalism degree. In the mid-1980s, I lived at a physics lab, CERN, outside of Geneva for the better part of a year, and I watched some very, very smart physicists discover non-existent elementary particles and ended up writing an expose instead of a book about their great discovery. And I became obsessed with how hard it is to do science right and how easy it is to get the wrong answer. And I thought, after the book came out and this physicist was quoted in the New York Post calling me, if you'll pardon the expression, an asshole, I thought I would never work again. And instead, all kinds of researchers kept saying, if you think this guy was bad, you should write about so-and-so. And that's what I ended up doing. I wrote a book about cold fusion, if you remember that, which was one of the great scientific fiascos of the 20th century, and I was obsessed again with how it got so much play when it was so obviously wrong. And after that, one of my friends in the physics community said, if you think the science of cold fusion is bad, you should look at some of this stuff in public health. And I moved into public health in the early 90s, and I winded my way through it, and I wrote about the question of whether salt causes high blood pressure and whether dietary fat really causes heart disease or not. And in 2002, I did a fairly infamous cover story for the New York Times Magazine called What If Fat Doesn't Make You Fat? And that got me a pretty large book advance that was enough to pay for 4 years of my life to do research for this book. Of course, I spent 5 years on it because that's what journalists do. Still doesn't stop my critics from saying that the only reason I'm writing this stuff is for the money. And this book, Good Calories, Bad Calories, is basically a book, an academic work of scholarship, the best I could do, that was written for professionals and researchers and doctors, and it was, you know, I did the best job I could to make it readable for the lay public, and I didn't do a good enough job. So I decided with my publisher that we'd write Why We Get Fat, which is, in effect, take some of the more important findings of Good Calories, Bad Calories. It's based on the lecture I'm going to give you today, and presents it in a way that's understandable and is, in effect, airplane reading. And airplane reading for physicians, too, because I want physicians to get this, because I actually have the hubris to think I'm right about it and they're wrong. And so I hope that people who read it and find it useful will then at least loan their copy to their doctor, because if their doctor doesn't understand it, we're in trouble. So Why We Get Fat. This is just the background. As you know, we have an obesity epidemic going on. I won't go into the details. We have a diabetes epidemic that goes with it. Diabetes diagnoses have tripled in the past 30 years, which is pretty serious. And there are all these diseases that associate with being overweight and obese, and they include virtually every chronic disease that we're likely to die of, type 2 diabetes, fatty liver disease, atherosclerosis, hypertension, stroke, cancer, asthma, sleep apnea, osteoarthritis, neurodegeneration. Alzheimer's is one of these diseases. If you are overweight or obese, the heavier you are, the more likely you are to get these diseases. And the current conventional wisdom is that there's something about fat, being fat, and you release all these inflammatory molecules. So the process of being fat is what then increases your risk of these diseases. And what my fundamental argument is, it is quite likely that whatever makes you fat also gives you heart disease, diabetes, cancer, Alzheimer's. So you should keep that in mind. And if there are any doctors in the audience, since 2/3 of your patients are likely to be overweight or obese, you want to figure out, you want to make sure you understand what indeed makes people fat. So why do we get fat? Simple question. Couple of obvious answers. The NIH says obesity occurs when a person consumes, they actually, that's my typo, not theirs, more calories from food than he or she burns. And the U.S. Surgeon General tells us that overweight is a result of caloric imbalance, too few calories expended for the amount of calories consumed. And this is a conventional wisdom, energy in over energy out, energy in minus energy out, okay? And I call this the, you'll see this in virtually every paper written in the field. Obesity is a disorder of energy balance. When I recently gave this talk in an obesity research center at the University of Alabama, Birmingham, I met with a very smart physician who actually was one of the few I've met with who said, look, we don't know how to treat diabetes. It's overrunning the medical system. I'll listen to anything you have to say. And I just said, can you define obesity? Fill in the blank. Obesity is a disorder of what? But you can't say energy balance. And he couldn't even think of a way to do it. This is so ingrained in the research, in the pharmaceutical industry research to try and cure the problem. It's completely ubiquitous. And in short, we overeat, okay? We overeat. And overeating includes, meaning you eat more than you expend. So it includes sedentary behavior. Here's, you know, that's it. Increase. Okay, so now the question is, if overeating causes obesity, what causes the obesity epidemic? Okay, because obesity rates have skyrocketed in the past 30 years, so we have to explain that. One of the things a good theory should do is explain observations in science. Actually, that is what a good theory should do, is explain observations. And the way we explain the obesity epidemic is increased prosperity. Okay, that's Marion Nestle, the NYU nutritionist line. We got richer as a society, and when you get richer, you have less reason to be physically active. Food is available everywhere. You know, there's a McDonald's at every counter. It tastes good, and you just can't help yourself. A toxic environment is a term that Kelly Brownell used. And the way Kelly Brownell described it, I'm not going to be able to do it because I can't get my screen to do what I wanted it to do. A toxic environment, in Kelly Brownell's terminology, is a place where, you know, cheese curls and potato chips and french fries and fast food and sodas are available everywhere, and we just can't say no to them. And parents keep their children home from, don't allow their children to walk to school anymore because they're afraid they'll be kidnapped. And everyone sits in front of the computers and plays video games and watches television. So there's too much palatable food available, and we don't have enough reason to work out. Okay, there was just an article in Scientific American, the cover story this week, where they quoted a study from Louisiana State University that claimed if we increased our stair walking by 2.8% a year, we'd all lose a pound. Okay, we don't walk upstairs enough. So the idea is increased prosperity causes overeating, causes energy in over energy out, and you end up with obesity and the obesity epidemic. Okay, so the question I ask doing my research is this true? You know, it's a hypothesis. It sounds obvious, but, you know, everything can sound obvious. What you want to know, is it true? And one of the ways you can do this in science is you could look for observations that refute the hypothesis, counterexamples, okay? And so one of the things I did, which the medical research community could have done and for some reason never bothered to, is I went back and I looked through the medical literature for every example of a population that I could find prior to the 1980s, when obesity research became such a huge endeavor it wasn't worth it anymore. but prior to the 1980s, to see if they had, you could find examples of populations that had high levels of obesity, but did not have a toxic environment, didn't have a food industry, didn't have children being kept home from school, computers, televisions, video games, all the things we blame obesity on. And the further, what you end up with is what I call the Fat Louisa paradox. This young lady is Fat Louisa, as that's how she was called in a 1902 textbook, a book on the Pima Indians that were written by a Harvard anthropologist named Frank Russell. And the Pima are now the poster children for obesity and diabetes in the United States. They probably have the highest rate of any population. They're a Native American group that live in a reservation that's south of Phoenix, Arizona. And what's little known about the Pima is they used to be the most affluent Native American tribe. And they hunted in the nearby mountains, they fished in the Gila River and ate clams from the Gila River. They were also agriculturalists. They grew corn and rice and beans, not rice, excuse me, corn and beans and wheat, and they raised, they had pigs. And in 1846, when a U.S. Army battalion went through the Pima territory, the battalion surgeon described them as lean and in fine health. And he said they had an abundance of food. And in fact, after gold was discovered in California in 1849, and one of the southernmost of three routes to California was the San Jose Trail, which went through the Pima territory. And the U.S. government asked the Pima to feed the 20 to 60,000 travelers that passed through over the next 20 years because they had so much food. Warehouses full of it, it was described. And this drawing of the Pima was actually made in 1951 by a traveler passing through their territory. And the question, the thing with the Pima is after, beginning in the 1870s, Anglo-Americans and Mexicans started moving into the Pima territory, and they diverted the Pima River water to irrigate their own fields instead of the Pima fields, and they overhunted the nearby mountains. And by the 1870s, the Pima entered into what they called the period of famine. And this lasted for 20 years. And by 1902, when this Harvard anthropologist Frank Russell comes to live with them, they're now on a reservation and they're surviving on government rations. And there's a level of poverty that's almost impossible to imagine. And now there's an obesity epidemic. And the way Russell put it, and I wish I could read this quote directly. Maybe I can if I use my own book. Usually it's on the screen. He said, guessing, that there was a level of obesity in the tribe, particularly the older people in the tribe, that was at complete odds to the image people had of the lean and healthy and athletic Native American. And he was the one who took this 1900 photo of Fat Louisa. So the reason I bring this up is our hypothesis says when a population becomes prosperous, improved prosperity causes the obesity epidemic. And here's an example of a population that went from prosperity through 30 years of famine into extreme poverty, and then they had an obesity problem. And 30 years of famine means 30 years of, in effect, being on a calorie-restricted diet, right? Of not getting to eat as much as you want. And after 30 years of being on such a diet, not having any choice, you would think that they would be lean if our hypothesis worked. And instead, you had this high level of obesity. So I went and looked for other examples, and I'm going to give you some of them. I found about a dozen, but I'll give you about four or five of them. In 1928, a couple of University of Chicago economists did a study of the South Dakota Crow Creek Reservation and the Native American tribe, the Sioux, that were living on it. And they reported the living conditions as extreme poverty. Something like 15 families on this reservation were subsisting on coffee and... How did they put it? I wish I could get to my notes. Let me see if I do it this way. There you go. You get the notes, too. Living conditions, 1 to 2 room shacks, unfit for occupancy, 4 to 8 people per room. 40% of the children were living in homes without toilet. Water is drawn from the river. 15 families with 32 children among them were living chiefly on bread and water. And yet, getting back to the slideshow, 40% of the women were distinctly fat, 25% of the men and 10% of the children, and 20% of the women and 25% of the men and children were extremely thin. So here you have a population that you could use as the photo in the dictionary next to the words dirt poor. They should be. There's no way they can be overeating because you've got this combination of obesity and malnutrition in the same population. And this is a combination we're going to see frequently in these, or at least we're going to come back to several times. African Americans in Charleston, South Carolina, the mean family income of these African Americans were $9 to $53 a week, and yet 30% of the women are obese and 18% of the men. Zulus in Durban, South Africa, 40% of the women were obese, and women in their 40s averaged 175 pounds. I think the average weight of women in America today is 165 pounds. Trinidad, 1961-63. Trinidad's having a malnutrition, a famine going on, and the U.S. government sends a team of nutritionists down to help out. And the team of nutritionists come back, and they report that a third of the women over 25 are obese, and that obesity is a potentially serious medical problem in women. And the per capita daily diet is less than 2,000 calories and 21% fat. Okay, that was fewer calories than recommended at the time by the Food and Agriculture Organization for minimum of a healthy diet. Bantu pensioners in South Africa, these were the poorest of the poor displaced population. 30% of the women are severely overweight, and the mean weight of women over 60 was 165 pounds. Rarotonga in the South Pacific, 40% of the women are obese. Over 25% were grossly obese. Factory workers in Chile, okay, 30% are obese. Nearly 50% of the women over 54 are obese. 10% suffer undernourishment. There's a combination again. And most are engaged in heavy labor. So they may not be, you know, walking or working out an hour a day. They may not be training for marathons. But if they're engaged in heavy labor, you could be pretty confident that they're physically active and more physically active than we are today, that their lives require more work than our lives require. And there's no toxic environment here. These people are working hard, and yet nearly 50% of the women over 54 are obese. And then the last study, Mexican Americans in Starr County, Texas. This was a UC Southwestern Medical Center cardiologist named William Mueller, who went down to Starr County, Texas, which is on the border of Mexico, and was studying heart disease in this Mexican-American population. And he reported that 50% of the women in their 50s are obese and 40% of the men in their 40s. And, quote, most inhabitants are employed in agricultural labor and or work in the oil fields in the country. So, again, there's nothing sedentary about their lives. These are hard-working, poor people, and they have high levels of obesity. And when I asked Mueller, when I interviewed him, whether there were restaurants and fast food joints in Starr County, Texas in 1981, he said there was one restaurant in the entire county, a Mexican restaurant. So the point is, why were these populations fat? Because if we believe that a toxic environment common to what we have in the United States, McDonald's and Burger King and KFC and all the rest are required to cause obesity and, you know, soda machines and televisions and computers and video games, then why were they fat? Because the way that science should work is, you know, to follow Occam's razor. We start with a simple hypothesis. Whatever makes those people fat probably makes us fat as well. And if it wasn't, you know, then if we can't conclude that that's true, then we could start complicating our hypothesis. Like, they got fat because they sat around, you know, in front of the campfire all day long, and we get fat because we sit around watching computers all day long. So this is how the question was phrased in 1973 by Ralph Richards at the University of the West Indies. Richards was a diabetes specialist from England who went to Jamaica in the early 1960s and founded a diabetes clinic. And he reported that two-thirds of the women, adult women in Jamaica, are obese. And he said, it's difficult to explain the high frequency of obesity seen in a relatively impecunious society such as exists in the West Indies when compared to the standard of living enjoyed in the more developed countries. Again, we expect the rich countries to be poor, to be obese, right? Because that's what our preconceptions tell us. Malnutrition and subnutrition are common disorders in the first 2 years of life in these areas and account for almost 25% of all admissions to pediatric wards in Jamaica. Subnutrition continues in early childhood to the early teens. So the young children aren't getting enough food. That's what he means by subnutrition. And the older women are obese. Okay, and we're going to get back to this again. Obesity begins to manifest itself in the female population from the 25th year of life and reaches enormous proportions from 30 onwards. So now I'm going to look at that exact same question, circa 2005. Now, you know, Richards was just curious, as we should be. What's going on here? Why are these women fat? Because these are poor people. Okay, and we think rich people should be fat. That's what our theory tells us. And 2005, Benjamin Caballero, who runs the Laboratory for Human Nutrition at Johns Hopkins University, a pretty good school, writes an article in the New England Journal of Medicine called Nutrition Paradox, the Coexistence of Obesity and Malnutrition. And Caballero puts it this way. He goes, a few years ago, I was visiting a primary care clinic in the slums of Sao Paulo, Brazil. Okay, now we're going to get the same observation steeped in this calories in, calories out overeating paradigm. The waiting room was full of mothers with thin, stunted young children exhibiting the typical signs of chronic undernutrition. Their appearance, sadly, would surprise few who visit poor urban areas in the developing world. What might come as a surprise is that many of the mothers holding those undernourished infants were themselves overweight. The coexistence of underweight and overweight poses a challenge to public health programs, since the aims of programs to reduce undernutrition are obviously in conflict with those for obesity prevention. Let me see if I can... Bad for the podcast. Here we go. I put this in, this is my italics and my bold, okay? The coexistence of obesity in an adult population and the mothers and undernourished infants doesn't pose a challenge to your public health programs. It poses a challenge to your fundamental paradigm, okay? Because what we know about maternal behavior, right, is that if a mother, if a child is starving, the mother will do anything she can to keep that child alive, okay? So if we believe that the mothers got fat because they were eating superfluous calories that they didn't need, that they're, in effect, sneaking outside to eat Snickers bars while they're letting their children starve, we have to throw out everything we know about maternal behavior. Okay, so what I'm saying is this observation poses a challenge to the paradigm. We either have to throw out what we know about maternal behavior, or we got to throw out what we know about our paradigm about obesity, and because of my mother, I'm going to throw out the obesity paradigm. Let's look at some other inconvenient observations. I mean, she would have, no way she's eating the Snickers bar if I'm starving. Eating less doesn't work. Overeating is supposed to cause obesity, but eating less doesn't work. You can look at any, you could pick any meta-analysis over the last 50 years, any systematic review. I tend to use the Cochrane Collaboration because this was formed to do unbiased reviews of the data. They have a methodology that makes sure that the researchers don't pick which studies they want to pay attention to based on the results of the studies. And as they put it, weight loss achieved in clinical trials of calorie-restricted diets is so small as to be clinically insignificant. So what happens, because the community knows that these diets don't work, they've decided, in effect, that sedentary behavior has caused the obesity epidemic. And in fact, you could see sedentary behavior blamed for all the diseases that associate with obesity. So diabetes, people even blame cancer on sedentary behavior. So you people sitting down in front of me right now are engaged in carcinogenic activity because you're sedentary. And so the reason is, you know, we can't prove that eating less works. The problem must be that people are too sedentary. And the problem is exercising, increasing your energy expenditure also doesn't work. And I could quote meta-analyses to this effect, but I find this much more compelling. In 2007, the American Heart Association, the American College of Sports Medicine, published their physical activity guidelines, okay? And what they said about energy expenditure and its relation to weight, they said it's reasonable to assume that persons with relatively high daily energy expenditures would be less likely to gain weight over time compared with those who have low energy expenditures. So that's like saying it's reasonable to assume that if you're sedentary right now and you decide to start training to run a marathon and become very active, you will be less likely to gain weight, right? Same logic. So far, data to support this hypothesis are not particularly compelling. And the point is, these are people who want us to exercise. They believe, as I do, that exercise is an inherent part of a healthy lifestyle. And yet the best they could say about this is so far data to support it are not particularly compelling. And the point I'm making is this hypothesis is at least a century old. You could go back to the 1890s, 1880s, even the 1860s, and have people suggesting that if we only exercised more, we would lose weight. And if a hypothesis is that old, and the best you could say about it is the data aren't compelling, the point is you should consider the possibility that it's wrong. Not that it absolutely is. You might have done the studies wrong. You never know. But there's a very good possibility that this idea is simply misplaced. That's the point I'm trying to make. Here's another problem. Practicing energy balance is impossible. Okay, this is a new phrase, by the way. The industry likes it a lot. They are going to teach you how to practice energy balance so you won't gain weight, okay? And that means you're going to match your intake to your expenditure. So you're going to decrease your intake and you're going to increase your expenditure. And, you know, here's the scale. Here's intake and expenditure. And if intake is greater then you gain weight. If expenditure is greater, then you lose weight. And right in the middle, there's this mythical point called weight maintenance. So what we want to know is, how accurately do we have to match intake to expenditure to make sure that we don't get obese? So let's say you're lean in your 20s, and you don't want to be obese in your 40s, so you don't want to gain 40 pounds in 20 years, so that's 20 pounds per decade. And we could calculate this. And the first time this calculation was ever done, by the way, was in a 1937 metabolism textbook written by the premier metabolism expert in the United States, Eugene Dubois. It's going to make the exact same point I'm going to make. So a typical American's food intake average is 2,700 calories a day. That's about 1 million calories a year, or 10 million calories in a decade, or about 10 to 12 tons of food per decade, depending on whose source you use. So the accuracy required to gain no more than 20 pounds over the course of a decade, and you can work that out, it comes to 20 calories a day. Okay? If you overeat by 20, if you take 20 calories a day and stick it in your fat tissue every day and don't burn it, 20 calories, that's like one bite of food, maybe three potato chips, you will be obese in 20 years, okay? Here's the calculation. 20 calories a day times 365 days a year times 10 years divided by 3,500 calories per pound of fat is 21 pounds in a decade, okay? It's simple math. And the point, it's 0.8% accuracy if we go back to the 2,700 calories per day. And the point that Eugene Dubois made, and he said working through these numbers, considering this accuracy, nobody can do that. Okay, nobody can count calories to that accuracy. We don't have any idea how much energy we're expending. Even the researchers who study it just use these, you know, they calculate it from our weight and other factors. But we don't have any idea how much. So nobody can do this. No human being can do this. I doubt there's a machine out there that could do it. So how do we maintain our weight? Because I guarantee that we're not, you know, matching our intake to our expenditure consciously to 20 calories a day. So one idea is, okay, maybe we just consciously undereat, you know, just don't eat too much. Not too much, like Michael Pollan says, or walk away from the plate hungry or stay hungry. But then why don't we become anorexic? Because this should work both ways, right? So we should all either be obese because we're overshooting on average, or we should look malnourished because we're undershooting on average. I mean, one way you could assume we do it is maybe we start getting a little fat, the belt gets snug, and then we say, okay, well, then I got to undereat. So now you undereat for a while, and then you overeat for a while, and you average. But then you ask the question, how do animals do it? Because animals don't get chronically obese. So how do they judge this intake to expenditure? And what Dubois said is, considering this calculation, the question isn't why do some of us get obese? The question scientists should be trying to answer is, why don't we all get obese? Okay? Because nobody can do this. Nobody can practice energy balance. Okay? Something doesn't mean our bodies don't practice energy balance, because if you're not actively gaining weight, your body is in energy balance. It's matching intake to expenditure, but you are not doing it consciously. Okay, genetics. And now I'm going to show photos. These come from pre-World War II European textbooks, and the theory that I'm basically channeling here is a pre-World War II European theory of obesity. The best science and virtually the only meaningful medical research in the world in genetics and endocrinology and metabolism, nutrition, were done in Europe prior to the Second World War. I should have said prior to the Second World War, were done in Europe. And they had a different theory of obesity. So one of the things they said is, look at genetics. What does genetics tell us? Here's a lean pair of identical twins, and here's an obese pair of identical twins, okay? Our theory that overeating causes obesity might explain why these women are fatter than these women. But it doesn't explain why they have the same body, and more importantly, why they have the same body. Okay? Because if we believe that genes, and genes play a huge role in obesity, if we believe that genes determine obesity, those genes determine how much these women ate and how much they sat on their couches rather than walking to work, or did it determine how they distributed body fat, where they put it, and maybe how much they put on? Okay? And another way to look at this is animal husbandry. You could look at, you know, for hundreds of years, farmers have been breeding cattle, sheep, pigs to be more or less fat. So here's a lean breed of cattle, a Jersey cow. And here's a fat breed of cattle, an Aberdeen Angus. And I might add, I couldn't use this photo in the book because it wasn't high definition. So I went out on the web and I got a high def photo at the last minute. And the photo in the book is of a bull. The photo in the book is of a bull. I've cattlemen from Texas keep writing me saying, you idiot, it is not a cow, it is a bull, and you can't compare bulls to cow. So now at this moment, a friend who lives in West Texas is going out to get me a cow, Aberdeen Angus. Hopefully it'll work. It's very embarrassing. I mean, the excuse is I'm an urban dweller. I'm a, you know, a Jew. I eat at Chinese restaurants. What do I know about cattle? Okay, this is a dairy cow. This is a meat cow. This one's lean. This one's fat. The question is, genetics determine that. What are the genetics breeding for? Okay, what are we breeding for? Does this cow take smaller bites? Does it walk away from the fields? Does it stop grazing earlier in the evening? Does this one take bigger bites? Does this one go, remember the Far Side cartoon? Maybe this one goes for a jog every night when nobody's looking, and this one sits in the farm and eats, and that's obviously absurd. You know, I mean, it's a joke. We are not breeding for how much these cows eat and how much they exercise. What you're obviously breeding for is maybe, you know, some you know, genes and hormones and MI that determine, you know, again, where it puts on fat, how much fat and muscle it wants to put on. You know, the fact that this is a dairy cow and this is a meat cow, it basically, think of this as a machine that takes in food here. I mean, it's cruel, but, you know, and gives us milk here. So you don't want to get rid, you don't want any calories accumulating here. It's a waste of fuel. You want the fuel going in here and ending up here. And in this animal, you want the fuel going in here and ending up here. So maybe what we're breeding for is what this technical term called fuel partitioning. Now, not how much the animals bring in, but how they partition, where they put the fuel they eat. So here's another example. Sexual variations. Men and women fatten differently, okay? Men put on their fat above the waist. Women put on their fat below the waist. So both of these would have overeaten because they got fat, right? But when you put it on over the waist, you double your risk of heart disease. And when you put it on below the waist, you don't. So what does how much they ate have to do with that when we look at heart disease? Oh, let's see if we have, yeah, puberty. Here's another way to think of it. Puberty, boy, and again, I'm channeling these pre-World War II Europeans. Boys and girls start off puberty having roughly the same amount of body fat. Boys go through puberty, they lose fat and gain muscle. Women, girls go through puberty, they gain fat in the breasts and the hips and the butt, and it's an evolutionary thing, right, to attract the boys. And the question is, both of them overeat, because both the boys and the girls get bigger. So they have to take in more calories than they expend, but the boys gain muscle and lose fat, and the girls gain fat. What does the fact that they overate have to do with it? So when I'm trying to get people off the calories in, calories out idea, I'm trying to get them to realize that it's just the wrong way to think about the problem. So here's another way to look at it. Final example, lipodystrophies. Okay, this again comes straight from the pre-World War II textbooks. This is a disorder called progressive lipodystrophy. By the 1950s, there are about 200 of them on record, 80% of them in women. The case is they start losing fat above the waist, and it moves progressively downward, this loss of subcutaneous fat. That's why it's called progressive. And then it usually stops right above the hips, and then they gain weight below the waist. So you get complete emaciation, no subcutaneous fat at all above the waist, lower body obesity, and the way these Europeans put it. And they said, what are we going to do? We're going to blame the top half on undereating and the bottom half on overeating? And that, again, is obviously absurd. Something else is involved here that has to do with how the fat tissue is regulated. And yet, if she had 10 more pounds of fat, actually, this particular woman was 5'4" and 185 or 205 pounds, I forget which, so she was clinically obese. She had a BMI of around 32. But just give her 10 more, 5 more pounds of fat on her upper body to smooth out the curves and make it a little more less obvious that she's got a what's called a lipodystrophy. And then she goes to the doctor's office and the doctor says, look, you're clinically obese. Eat less, exercise more. So why do we believe this calories in, calories out stuff? Okay, where did this come from? And why is it that every time I talk about this, or it's on a blog, or somebody who doesn't like my book reviews it, they say Gary Taubes doesn't believe in the laws of thermodynamics? I had a physics degree from Harvard. Actually, one of my fondest moments when my last book came out, I was on the Larry King show, and Jillian Michaels, the trainer from The Biggest Loser, came on from Los Angeles and gave me a lecture about thermodynamics on the air and about how I didn't understand the laws of thermodynamics. I mean, I was a lousy physics student. I was a B-minus student at Harvard, which is the equivalent of being like a D anywhere else because you can't lose, you know, graduate students will lose their scholarships if they have a grade less than a B minus. But I was just, I didn't know what to say. I was literally speechless. There was no way I could reply to Jillian on the TV. First law of thermodynamics. This is what it tells you. This is why we believe calories in, calories out are what's important. Change of energy, it's a law of energy conservation. Energy is conserved. So you can't make energy up and you can't make it vanish. It just changes form. But in this form, it says change of energy in a system. Delta E means a change of energy. E means energy. It's equal to the energy in minus the energy out. Okay, so for all intents and purposes, we're talking about the fat mass, and that's equal to energy consumed minus energy expended. That's why we believe this. And the idea is, if E in goes up, if you eat more, and there isn't a compensatory increase in expenditure, delta E has to go up, right? Therefore, eating too much causes obesity. And if E out goes down and there isn't a compensatory, if you don't eat less, but you just expend less, then delta E goes up. And, you know, sedentary behavior causes obesity. And now the problem is, so that's why we believe it. But the problem is, this is an equal sign. There's no causality in this equation. This is a mistake. This is like an eighth grade science mistake that everyone believes and no one's thought about. And it's stunning to me. And I made it up until about 7 years ago. But this equation tells you absolutely nothing about what causes obesity. What it says is if a system gets bigger, if a person gets fatter and heavier, they have to take in more energy than they expend. And if they get lighter, they have to expend more energy than they take in. It says absolutely nothing about why either one of those happens. There's no causality here. And the way I put it in the book, I say it says nothing more about how we get fat than any other law of physics. Like Einstein's relativity, always true, tells us nothing about why we get fat. Quantum mechanics, always true, tells us nothing about why we get fat. And one example, let's say, here's a way to think about it. I'm going to give you an exact metaphor for this. Let's say people outside want to know, why is this area of the library crowded? Okay? And that's like saying, when you want to say, why is this person fat? That fat has a lot of energy. So you want to know, why has that person accumulated all this energy in his fat tissue? And we want to know, why has this part of the room accumulated all this energy in the form of people? So you say, Gary, why is this form part of the room crowded? And I say, well, because more people came over here than left. It's exactly the equivalent of saying, because more energy entered than exited. And it tells you absolutely nothing. And then you should respond, of course more people came over here than left. I know that, but why is it crowded? And I say, but if more people enter than leave, it has to get crowded, right? And I still haven't told you anything meaningful about why you guys are all standing here, okay? It's what logicians call vacuously true. It's true, but it means nothing. If somebody tells you that you got fat because you took in more energy than you expended, you say, first of all, there's no causality in that. So yes, I took in more energy than I expended, but why? Here's another metaphor that I got from a blogger named Chris Downey. I got to give him credit because it's better than mine. We want to know why Warren Buffett is rich, why he has a fat bank account, and we're poor, we have a lean bank account. So you ask me why, and I say, because he took in more money than he spent. Same, exact same logic, tells you nothing. Okay, this law tells you absolutely nothing about why we get fat. One of my goals in life is to get people to stop using it. I'm a crusade. If I can get the obesity research community to realize this, I will. And I know it's shocking that I get it and they don't, because I'm just a journalist, but I just read the literature. They didn't. Independent variables. When you tell someone that they can increase their the way to lose weight is to decrease your intake and keep your expenditure the same, or to increase your expenditure and don't eat more, don't increase intake, you're assuming that E in and E out are what mathematicians call independent variables, that they aren't connected in any way, okay? So it is possible to just go to the gym, increase your expenditure, don't eat more, and then delta E, your fat mass has to get smaller. And one example way to think about this is there used to be a concept, raise your hand if you remember this, called working up an appetite. Anyone remember that? Yeah, there we go. If you worked out, you know, the doctor would say, look, play a couple sets of tennis, go for a hike, you know, 18 holes of golf. I mean, I guess here you'd cross-country ski. All those are meaningless. you're going to work up an appetite. These variables are connected, in and out. If you increase expenditure, your body tries to increase intake. It tries to match energy balance. It tries to match E in, T out. Actually, if you decrease expenditure, you can do this with animals, the E in will come out. And this is how it was described by Jeff Flyer and Terry Meritos Flyer in Scientific American in 2007. Jeff is now dean of Harvard Medical School. He and his wife are both obesity researchers. They said, talking about lowering energy intake, an animal whose food is suddenly restricted tends to reduce its energy expenditure both by being less active and by slowing energy use in cells, thereby limiting weight loss. So if you reduce intake, and you, with an animal, you can't just tell it to eat less because it's going to ignore you. You actually have to give it less food. It actually expends less. It doesn't just become physically inactive. Its metabolism slows down. Its body temperature drops. It burns less fuel because it has less fuel to burn. It also experiences increased hunger, so that once a restriction ends, it'll eat more than its prior norm until the earlier weight is attained. Likewise, after intentional overfeeding, you can increase E in. Force feed the animal, and it will increase its expenditure, will start to expend more energy and exhibit reduced appetite, with both states persisting until weight falls. And what I always wondered, and I've wanted to ask the Flyers, is why'd they say an animal? Because they could have said a human. This was demonstrated in humans in 1917, that if you calorie restrict humans, they reduces its energy expenditure both by being less active and by slowing energy use. But if they had said humans, then Scientific American is saying diets don't work and we know why. Okay? E in and E out are dependent variables. Just like when you sweat and perspire, you lose body water, you get thirsty. I'm thirsty right now because I'm working hard. Your body wants to replete the water. When you expend energy, your body wants to replete the energy. So this is how you should think about it. Did I have an introductory slide? Yes, the alternative hypothesis. This is how the pre-World War II Europeans thought about it. And they started with the simplest possible statement of the problem. Obesity is the sort of excess fat accumulation. Lesson number one in science, I would like to write a book someday about how to do experimental science. Start with the simplest possible explanation, the simplest possible sentence, no assumptions whatsoever. You could say, having too much fat is a disorder of having too much fat. And it sounds obvious, but if you're a doctor or researcher, the very first question you might ask is, what regulates fat accumulation? Okay, because we don't care how much a person eats or how sedentary they are. We're just interested in why they have too much fat. So in this hypothesis, obesity is not a sort of energy balance, overeating, or sedentary behavior. And overeating and inactivity are compensatory effects. They're not causes. I'll explain that in a minute. We don't get fat because we overeat. We overeat because our fat tissue is accumulating excess fat. And here's the analogy that the pre-World War II Europeans used. And I'm going to take a drink for a second. And by the way, I realize as I speak that once more I am going on. And the idea that this is going to be a 45-minute talk, it's probably already 45 minutes. I'm afraid to look at my watch. Anyone who wants to leave, feel free to leave. You won't insult me. Here's the analogy, a growing child, okay? Here's a particularly cute young boy. 2006, he was 1 year old, he weighed 20 pounds. Here's the same boy, 3 years later, he weighed 45 pounds, okay? He gained 25 pounds in 3 years. He had to take in more calories than he expended to do it. He overate, right? Okay? But he did not grow because he overate. He overate because he was growing. He was growing because he was secreting growth hormone, and the growth hormone made his cells want to grow, and he had all these structures in his body that he had to build, like bone and connective tissue, and his organs had to get bigger. So growth was the cause. Overeating, taking in more calories than you expend, was the effect. You can think of another example, is cancer, tumors. Tumors grow, that's the problem, and because they grow, it means they're taking in more energy than they expend. That's what the laws of thermodynamics. But we don't care. We don't talk about cancer as a disorder of energy balance. We want to know, why is the thing growing? Because if it's growing, that's what's going to cause it. Here's our gruesome analogy, cancer. Okay, so the Germans and Austrians had a theory for this. They called it lipophilia, which technically means love of fat. It was a German hypothesis pre-World War II. By 1940, it was more or less accepted in Europe. The problem is 1940 was a very bad year for Europe. It was started by Gustav von Bergmann in 1908, who went on to become the leading expert in internal medicine in Germany. Actually, the most prestigious award by the German Society of Internal Medicine is the Gustav von Bergmann Award. Julius Bauer took it up in the 1920s. He was a University of Vienna geneticist and endocrinologist. He's still famous today in Austria, but he's never heard of him. And I said, by 1940, he was more or less fully accepted. The idea was that certain tissues just have a propensity to take up fat. Lipophilia means love of fat. And the example they used, one of the examples von Bergmann talked about, was in the early part of the 20th century, there was a young girl, actually in the late 19th century, a young girl who had a bad burn on the back of her hand. So they took a graft from her stomach and put it on the back of her hand, and she grew up to be obese, and she had a big tuft of fat on the back of her hand. And these, you know, there are places we grow fat and places we don't. So, for instance, very few people put on fat on their foreheads or fat on the back of their hands, and yet here was this tuft of fat, which told these researchers that there was something regulating what determined how much fat she was going to come. Absorb, and it could move with the skin, with the tissue. So there were tissue-specific factors that determined fat accumulation. So this is how Bauer put it in 1929. He said, like a malignant tumor, like the fetus, the uterus, or the breast of a pregnant woman, the abnormal lipophilic tissue seizes on foodstuffs, even in the case of undernutrition. Remember, we've been talking about populations with undernutrition and obese adults. It maintains its stock and may increase it independent of the requirements of the organism. A sort of anarchy exists. The adipose tissue lives for itself and does not fit into the precisely regulated management of the whole organism. So basically, a way, like a metaphor they used was hair. They said, just like we grow hair in some places, but not in others, we grow fat in some places, but not in others. And just as some people are hairier than others, some people are fatter than others. And this whatever it is, this fatness thing is determined by the lipophilic tendencies of the tissue, and that's regulated as genes regulate everything, primarily through hormones and enzymes, central nervous system factors. So, hello. Animal models. First thing you could ask yourself, which I did, is do animal models agree with this picture of obesity as a dysregulation of the fat tissue? Or do they agree with the idea that obesity is caused by eating too much? Tell you a quick story. The short answer is every single animal model of obesity, of which there are many that I found, fall into two groups. Either the animals... here's how you could test it. Let me tell you the story. Here's the story that got me started on this. I was interviewing a fellow at University of Massachusetts named George Wade, who in the 1970s did studies in which he was interested in animal reproduction. He wanted to know why female animals put on fat, just like female humans do. But he didn't think when they get pregnant. And he didn't think they do it because they're gluttonous or slothful or consciously eating for two. He was wondering what hormones controlled this. So he removed the estrogen from female rats. Okay, obviously, and he did it by removing the ovaries, which is a particularly brutal way to do it. And he noticed after the surgery that the animals would eat voraciously and would then very quickly become obese. And if you just do that experiment, what you would think is if you remove estrogen, you know, remove the ovaries, that somehow makes the animal eat too much, right? Because the animals would eat voraciously, and that causes obesity. So it confirms your preconceptions. But then what he did is a second experiment where he removed the ovaries, but he didn't allow the animals to eat any more than they did to begin with, okay, prior to the surgery. He controlled for overeating, what these researchers called hyperphagia, excessive voracious appetite. So even if the animals wanted to eat voraciously, they couldn't. And he said to me, actually, when he described this to me, it was like a Socratic dialogue. And he said, what do you think happened? And I said, I have no idea. And the answer was they got just as fat, just as quick. So if you do the second experiment, you think, okay, removing the estrogen obviously makes the animals sedentary because that's what happened to them. These animals that weren't allowed to overeat became extremely sedentary. They wouldn't move. In fact, they would only move to get food. So you do the first experiment, you think gluttony causes obesity and estrogen causes gluttony. You do the second experiment, you think sedentary behavior causes fat and removing estrogen causes sedentary behavior. Do them both, and you conclude, as Wade did, that removing the estrogen actually makes the animal accumulate fat. This is not an overreactomized rat. I just like that one. What it does is actually downrates an it downregulates an enzyme on the fat tissue called lipoprotein lipase. Estrogen actually suppresses this enzyme called lipoprotein lipase. And estrogen, LPL for short, pulls calories into the fat tissue. That's its job. So by suppressing that, estrogen keeps fat accumulation down. You remove the estrogen and the LPL shoots up on the fat tissue and the fat starts gobbling up calories. And now the animal has to compensate because it's losing calories into its fat tissue. So what it does, if it can, it eats more. So you get this hyperphagia, this voracious appetite. If it can't do that, then it expends less because it has less calories to consume, because just like Bauer said, the fat tissue is acting like a cancer. It's taking everything and it doesn't care what happens to the rest of the body. And Wade was the first one to say to me, this animal doesn't get fat because it overeats. It overeats because we literally made it fat. So all you have to do with an animal model of obesity is see whether or not the animals get fat, even if you don't allow them to eat any more than a lean animal. And every time that experiment has been done, half the time people don't do it because they assume that their animals get fat by eating too much, and they never think to do this. But when people do do it, they report that the animal at least gets fatter than lean animals, if not more, you know, as obese as it does when you allow it to eat as much as it wants. And Joel Meyer was the most influential nutritionist in the world in the 1960s. He had a strain of mice, genetic mice, that were fat, and he said these mice will make fat out of their food under the most unlikely circumstances, even when half-starved. So it's not that they get fat by overeating. They get fat by eating. Okay, the only way you can keep these animals from getting fat is to literally starve them. And then they will still be fatter than lean animals, most of these. They just will be leaner than they would be if you let them eat as much as they want. So here are the obvious questions. Vertical growth, but not horizontal growth. You know, when we grow taller, growth is the cause, overeating is the effect. In animals who are fat, growth is the cause, overeating is the effect. And then if obesity is a sort of excess fat accumulation, what regulates fat accumulation? And this is adiposity 101, what I call it. By the way, when somebody tells you that you get fat because you're overeater, you hear that. They don't care about how or why fat accumulates calories. What determines whether a fat cell is going to have a little bit of fat in it or a lot of fat? Completely, usually they don't know, although often I give this lectures to doctors and they say, you know, I was taught all that in med school, but nobody ever said it was relevant to human obesity, because we know what caused obesity. It's eating too much. So now it's going to get a little technical, and I apologize, but not that bad. There are two forms of fat we care about when we talk about fat storage: triglycerides and fatty acids. And a triglyceride is three fatty acids joined together by this glycerol molecule. That's why it's called a triglyceride. And fat is stored in your fat cells as triglyceride. And the reason is because the triglycerides by themselves are too big to pass through the cell membrane of the fat cell. Okay, so once they get inside, the fat enters and exits the cell as fatty acids, because the fatty acids by themselves can slip through the membrane of the fat cell, and then inside they are put together in these triglycerides that are too big to get out. It's like if you've ever had this happen, you buy a piece of furniture and you bring it home and it's too big to fit into the room you want to put it in, so you have to take it apart, move it through the wall, and then put it back together again. That's what happens with fat cells and fat. So fat is stored as triglycerides. We burn fatty acids for fuel. Fatty acids are the form in which fat enters and exits the fat cells. And inside the fat cells, fatty acids continually cycle into triglycerides and back again. So you get this kind of activity. Here's the fatty acids moving back and forth through the membrane. And that enzyme I told you about, LPL, basically reaches into the bloodstream and breaks down triglycerides that are floating around in lipoproteins like LDL, the bad cholesterol. So it breaks down the triglyceride into fatty acids. Fatty acids pass through the membrane, and then they're put together into triglycerides. And if anything, then if they get broken down again, which they will, they can pass out of the membrane again. So the idea, here's where the whole energy balance thing matters. You get fatter if more energy in the form of fatty acids enters your fat cells and leave it, and you get leaner if more energy leaves the fat cell. And what you want to know is what regulates this. So anything that works to break down a triglyceride into its component fatty acid works to make you leaner, and anything that works to what's called esterify fatty acids into a triglyceride works to make you fatter. Okay? And the interesting thing is that has been known since the early 1960s. I'm going to switch this diagram, just ignore the diagram. Insulin, the hormone insulin, is the principal regulator of fat metabolism, okay? And what that means, it's interesting, you know, the German community started vanishing in 1933. By 1940, they were gone. Post-war, we didn't care what the Germans had to say about anything, and most of the stuff was written in the German medical literature, the Austrian medical literature in German. It wasn't until the late 1950s that the technologies existed to actually determine what regulates fat metabolism. You needed two technologies: a way to measure fatty acids in the bloodstream and a way to measure hormones accurately. Rosalind Yalow and Solomon Burson discovered the way to measure hormones. They published it in 59 or 60. Yalow won the Nobel Prize for it. Burson didn't live long enough to do it. By the early 1960s, we knew that insulin was the principal regulator of fat metabolism. Okay, insulin is the one hormone, trust me, bad diagram, that works to put fat in the fat tissue. And the funny thing is, it had always been known that insulin was a fat-generating hormone. This is Best and Heist. Best is the Best who discovered insulin in Toronto with Banting in 1921. In 1966, in the Physiological Basis of Medical Practice, they said the fact that insulin increases the formation of fat has been obvious ever since the first emaciated dog or diabetic patient demonstrated a fine pad of adipose tissue made as a result of treatment with the hormone. Here's a particularly graphic example. This is a young lady who had a type 1 diabetic. She was diagnosed in 1947, if I remember correctly, and for the next 40-odd years, she injected herself with her insulin in two spots in her thighs. This is from a 2001 textbook. And she ended up with these huge fat masses on both sides. And the way this textbook put it is, the overall action of insulin on the adipocyte, a fat cell, is to stimulate fat storage and inhibit mobilization. And the remarkable effects of locally injected insulin are right there. It doesn't matter how much she ate or exercised. The insulin was literally making her fat. So when you actually pay attention to the biochemistry, physiology of fat metabolism, these are the conclusions you come to. When insulin is secreted or chronically elevated, fat accumulates in the fat tissue. When insulin levels drop, fat escapes from the fat tissue and the fat depots shrink. The fundamental thing you have to do to get fat out of your fat cells is lower insulin levels. And this isn't controversial, by the way. I mean, there's a med school part of the library. When you're done, anyone who doubts it, go to one of the biochemistry endocrinology textbooks, look up the word adipocyte, which is a technical term for fat cell, and look at what it says, and it will tell you all the ways that insulin puts fat in your fat cell, and it probably won't mention a single other hormone. We secrete insulin primarily in response to the carbohydrates in our diet, okay? So the way this was described to me, by the way, when I give this talk to doctors, this is the first time you notice I use the word carbohydrate, okay? So when I give this talk to doctors, you always say, they're with me up until now, and suddenly I see them going, oh my God, it's that Atkins crap, okay? Like, he snuck up on me. I bought it until now, but now I know he's a quack. Okay? Even though everything he said seemed logical, it's that Atkins stuff. 1965, the American Society of Physiology publishes a 500-page handbook of adipose tissue metabolism. The purpose is to take this remarkable science of fat metabolism that had come to fruition between 1955 and 65 and to put it in one book so people who didn't read the biochemistry and the physiology textbooks could get it. And that book was co-edited by George Cahill. And I didn't read the book, I skimmed the book. It's big and it's documented, but I called up Cahill, was still alive. He was a Harvard professor. He was a famous diabetes specialist. He was science director for the Howard Hughes Medical Institute for 20 years. And I called up Cahill in New Hampshire and I said, I just read this book, 1965, and the message is basically insulin is regulating fat accumulation and carbohydrates are raising insulin. And Cahill put it this way. He said, yes, carbohydrate is driving insulin, is driving fat. Okay? And if you just remove these three words as driving insulin, you have logically equivalent carbohydrate is driving fat. Okay? Carbohydrates literally make us fat. Okay? And the question is, should this be surprising? And until the 1960s, the conventional wisdom was that carbohydrates make people fat, that they are literally fattening. This line, this was the first sentence of an article in the British Journal of Nutrition in 1963, written by one of the co-author of the British dietetics textbook that was in play from the 1960s to 1970s. Every woman knows that carbohydrates are fattening. This is a piece of common knowledge which few nutritionists would dispute. This line was in every six editions of Dr. Spock's Baby and Child Care from 1946 to 1992. The amount of plain starchy foods taken and what determines in the case of most people how much weight they gain or lose. Okay, my mother grew up believing that rice, pasta, potatoes, sweets, beer, sodas, fruit juices, you know, bread was fattening. And what happened in the 1960s, I mean, here's, give you another example. If you went to the medical textbooks, the problem is even the researchers, medical researchers, the historians, when they look into this question, what they do is they would go to the popular, the histories of dieting, okay? So what they would get was the diet crazes that came and went, but they wouldn't actually look in the textbooks or the medical literature to see what happened when you went into a hospital and you were obese prior to the 1960s. And this is Raymond Green in the practice of endocrinology. Raymond Green was the most influential British endocrinologist of the mid-20th century. He's the brother of Graham Green, the novelist. Foods to be avoided, bread and everything else made with flour, cereals including breakfast cereals, potatoes and all other white root vegetables, foods containing much sugar, all sweets. You can eat as much as you like, meat, fish, birds, all green vegetables, eggs, dried or fresh, trees, and fruit except bananas and grapes. It's basically the Atkins diet except for the fruit. Okay? So this is the conclusions, okay? And I can answer, I'll answer questions as long as we want. Obesity is sort of fat accumulation, not energy balance, okay? Actually, I'm going to skip the conclusions for a second. I'm going to tell you what I was about to tell you. Up until the 1960s, carbohydrates were considered fattening, okay? Conventional wisdom. You can find this in the beginning in about 1825 when Antoine Briot-Savarin, famous Frenchman, wrote the single most famous book about food, Physiology of Taste. He says, I know why people get fat. All the people I know are fat. Tell me how much they love bread, potatoes, pasta, and sugar makes everything worse. And he actually has a diet for obesity, which is don't eat bread, potatoes, pasta, and don't eat sugar. You can find it through the literature, it's constantly in the literature, okay? And in the diet, in the textbooks. And then what happens is we start to believe that dietary fat causes heart disease, okay? Ansel Keys, University of Minnesota, convinces an entire nation that dietary fat causes heart disease. And if fat causes heart disease, then two ways to look at it. Dietary fat also has to cause obesity because obesity and heart disease coexist in the same patients in the same communities. And if you're going to tell people to eat less fat, you tell them to eat more carbohydrates. So you end up with the food guide pyramid, where the base of the food guide pyramid are the exact same carbohydrates that my mother's generation grew up believing cause obesity. Okay, pasta, bread, potatoes, and we're supposed to eat 7 or 9 portions a day. And sugar gets a free pass, high fructose corn syrup, because there's no fat in it. I have an American Heart Association pamphlet from 1996 that recommends that in order to lower the fat content of your diet, you should eat, among other things, more sugar. Obesity is a sort of fat accumulation, not energy balance, not overeating, and sedentary behavior. Fat accumulation is regulated fundamentally by insulin and dietary carbohydrates. Carbohydrate is driving insulin, is driving fat. The only non-pharmaceutical remedy is to restrict or remove the causative agent, which is the carbohydrates. Carbohydrates are literally fattening. It's unfortunate. Not all of them, not broccoli, because there's actually very few digestible carbohydrates in broccoli or green leafy vegetables, but they're literally fattening. Lean people can tolerate them. Those of us who are predisposed to gain weight cannot. The metaphor I use in the book are cigarettes, okay? Only 1 in 10 smokers will get lung cancer. But of people who have lung cancer, most of them get it. Some 85 to 90% get it because they smoked, okay? Cigarettes cause lung cancer. Carbohydrates do not make everybody fat. They do not make my brother fat, who is 6'5" and weighs 160 pounds, okay? But for the people who gain weight easily, what their genetics are predisposing to them is this intolerance to carbohydrates. So of the people who get fat, it's the carbs who do it, that did it. And one way to think about it is, you know, for every gene, there's a gene, you know, nature and nurture, gene-environment interactions. So you have a genotype, and the genotype is this intolerance to carbohydrates that drive fat into your fat tissue and make you sedentary and give you these urges to eat more than your lean sibling does. And the phenotype only manifests itself in a carbohydrate-rich world. And if that carbohydrate-rich world is a world in which everyone is told to eat carbs, because they're now heart-healthy diet foods, then you end up with obesity rampant, because everybody's doing exactly the wrong thing. So that's my message. I mean, I answer as many questions. I can stay here indefinitely, because I love talking about this stuff, and my wife is sick of it. Thank you very much. Anyone who wants... anyone who wants to leave, just so that there's no... Okay, question. Yes.
Is somebody testing your carbohydrate hypothesis? You talked about at the end, the good calories, bad calories.
There's actually a group at Duke that's been thinking about a way to do a large-scale test of a low-carb versus a low-fat diet of like 100,000 subjects and do it over the internet and like mediate it through the internet so it costs only about $70 to $100 million rather than $2 billion. I haven't spoken to them in a couple of years. Yeah, they insisted that they were getting help from the NIH on designing it. But the answer I would say is, in general, probably not yet. I have other experiments that I think should be done. I mean, one of the problems here, and I really, the epilogue to this book, my editor, you know, when you write this stuff and you realize what's going on, like the science of fat metabolism is beautiful science. And nobody cares. You know, it's just basically 50 years of beautiful science, one beautiful experiment after another that gets thrown out instantly as soon as you say overeating makes you fat. And so you're writing about this stuff, you have a tendency to get angry. And one of the problems when Atkins wrote his book is he was angry and he let it go. And then the community squashed him because they didn't like the fact that he was throwing his righteousness back in their face. So anyway, my editor took all that out of the book, but he let me keep it in the epilogue, where I suggested that I literally did not use the word scientist to describe anyone in the book, okay, because I didn't think of them as scientists, because they don't do science as I know it. They don't care whether they're right or wrong, you know? They have an idea. I mean, they care, but they're willing to jump to conclusions and take leaps of faith and be sloppy and not, you know, get rid of negative evidence, because that's how it's done, because people are dying out there. So I think actually the whole field has to rethink how they do things. And I have a lot of problems. You know, I'm just a journalist, but I have a lot of problems with a lot of the various, you know, like observational studies that don't determine cause and effect. And basically what you have to do is treat human beings like, you know, lab animals. And these are expensive. You got to put them in metabolic wards, and you got to feed them foods, and you got to make sure they eat it, and you got to keep them there for 3 months. So you have, you know, the whatever weight they gain or lose, you can is statistically significant. These are expensive experiments. So there are experiments I'd like to get the field to do if I can get them to pay attention. Like, I would like this book just to be popular enough that the arguments I make can't be ignored, that they have to be addressed. You know, that's why I want it to sell. I mean, it's nice making money and all that, but if I could get it to the point that every researcher goes, oh, I got to read Taubes, Jesus, you know. So anyway, there are experiments. Yes, next question.
Can you test it in an animal model?
You can, and it has been. You know, that's the problem. But the problem with animal models, like, one of the reasons we believe dietary fat causes obesity is some rats get obese on high-fat diets. You know, but rats aren't humans. Like, rats in the laboratory eat 6 to 8% fat. So you can test the general hypothesis that the reason they get fat is not because they eat too much, because you dysregulate their fat tissue. But, yes?
But in the animal models, you can also test the hypothesis about insulin. You can test the hormone levels, and you can do the metabolic.
But you even don't know, you know, are they secreting insulin to something other than what humans are secreting insulin to? You know, are they, like, if what I was going to say about rats, they eat 6 to 8% fat diets, both in the laboratory and in the wild. So when you feed them a 60% fat diet, who knows what's going on with their insulin secretion, and is it relevant? The key word is model. And when I was writing about high-energy physics, the physicists considered if a new discovery came out or a new claim and was based on a model, they would say it's model-dependent. This was a pejorative term, and they didn't have to read the paper. They could just throw it out because they had other things to do. And that's the problem with animal models. And they're everywhere. You know, there's thousands of them, and people don't pay attention to them. So, like, for instance, I have an idea for an experiment that would cost about $1.5 million to $2 million with real humans. But if it came out the way I think it would come out, people would have to pay attention. They'd have to say, hey, you know, maybe my theory that it's all about eating too much and exercising too little is wrong. But the animal models come out, you know, there's 50 new papers a day and nobody pays attention. I mean, the people, if they agree with the preconceptions, then you pay attention. And if they disagree, you don't. Yes.
And what about whole grains? Do you consider those bad carbs too?
Depends on your body type, you know. Stand up for a second. You can probably eat whole grains, okay? No, I mean, literally, you know, here's where, like, one of the problems I get into is I actually think Atkins was a pretty smart guy, you know. I mean, he was a cowboy and he had personality issues that I would have too if I didn't have him as an example of what happens to people who get carried away. But one of the things he said, look, give up carbs. This is the early Atkins before it became kind of more politically correct. But the idea is you give up the carbs. If you go on a diet, your idea is to lose weight. Okay, you want to get down to being as lean as you can. So you get rid of the carbs in the diet. You get down, you know, he called it an induction phase, and then it gets confusing. But the idea is basically so you're burning your own fat. Once you lower insulin levels, you start burning your own fat, okay? Which is what you want to do with it. And you get rid of the carbs, and you get down to a level where you like you're at a good weight. And now you could add back the carbs and see what your body can tolerate, okay? And the fact is, if you're lean and you're eating whole grains right now, obviously you can tolerate whole grains. But even whole grains, you know, there's this glycemic index. How many people know what the glycemic index is? Okay. You know, you can take a whole grain and refine it to the point that its glycemic index is the same as white bread. And what we're talking about is it's actually a different paradigm for nutrition. I talk about this in Good Calories, Bad Calories. You know, nutritionists grew up, their big triumphs in the early part of the 20th century were vitamin deficiency diseases and the discovery of vitamins, and they came to believe that this is what's important. And what I'm saying is what's important is how quickly you digest the carbohydrates, so the glycemic index, and the fructose content, so the effect on the liver of fructose. And if you don't have, you know, if you're eating only low glycemic index foods and there's not a lot of fructose and you're not very sensitive to it, you're not going to need the vitamins, basically. I mean, you're going to get them in these foods anyways. This is where I agree with Michael Pollan. If you're eating food, you know, instead of food-like substances, you'll be fine. But it's not about the vitamin. And when you talk about whole grains, you're going, well, we want the protein and the vitamins and the minerals and all that stuff. But what we're talking about here is the effect, how quickly you digest these things, how quickly they get dumped into your bloodstream as glucose or dumped onto your liver as fructose. And the other issue, when I'm writing a book like this, I'm writing it for people who are, you know, exercise nuts who just want to eat the healthiest possible meal and don't have a single excess pound of body fat, to people who are, you know, 100 pounds overweight. And one of the problems, we have a blanket recommendation. Fruits and vegetables are healthy for a diet. We should all eat fruits and vegetables. And, you know, the more the better, and Weight Watchers gives you a free pass. But if you're 100 pounds overweight or 50 pounds overweight, fruits, for starters, may not be a good idea. They may be part of the reason you're fat, and they may be keeping you fat. But if you're lean, then by all means, eat fruits and vegetables. You know, so one of the messages that come out of here is lean people are different than fat people, even though lean people often become fat people. Okay? But when you are lean, you are different. What your body can tolerate is an entirely different thing than what somebody who's predisposed to get fat can tolerate. You know, my brother can eat foods I can't touch without gaining 20 pounds. Okay? Let me go in the back just for a start, and then we'll come back up front.
I'm just wondering, the obesity epidemic that's reared its head in the past 34 years, you're saying that it's due to Americans eating more carbohydrates. It has nothing to do with activity levels.
Nothing to do with activity levels. As a matter of fact, it coincides with a physical activity epidemic. You know, the idea that anyone worked out in the 1960s, like nobody worked out in the 1960s except Jack LaLanne.
We had a lot less transportation options. People actually.
You know, but the problem is when you think like that, you're thinking statistically. Okay, the world is full of obese people who work out, obese people who are forced. You know, what you missed was I gave you populations of beginning, like Mexican Americans in Starr County, Texas, who had high levels of obesity but worked in the oil fields or as agricultural laborers. So you could find examples of extremely physically active people. who nevertheless had, you know, Chilean factory workers engaged in heavy labor. Those examples are in the literature. So when you believe in, calories out, you immediately go, well, sure, then they just ate too much. You don't actually care anything about these people. Like Charles Barkley, okay, he eats too much, doesn't care that he was a great basketball player, he just eats too much. The point is, again, in the 1960s, carbohydrates were fattening, and we actually discovered why they were fattening. This should have been a great breakthrough in modern medical science. We have this conventional wisdom that carbs make you fat. We've now unraveled the endocrinology, biochemistry. We know exactly how and why they make you fat. And then we flipped this over. Beginning in 1977, I discuss this in great length in the book, began this process of institutionalizing the low-fat, high-carbohydrate diet as the healthy diet. So carbs went from being inherently fattening to being, you know, heart-healthy diet foods. And then on top of that, high-fructose corn syrup came in 1977. And we didn't realize that high-fructose corn syrup was sugar. So sugar consumption, which had remained constant pretty much from the 1920s through the 1960s, suddenly turns upward with the introduction of high fructose corn syrup. And there are theories that there's something special about high fructose corn syrup, and it's different than sugar. But if you just go back to the 1980s and read the literature, what you find is we just didn't know it was sugar. Actually, when I was doing research for Good Calories, Bad Calories, I would come upon researchers who didn't realize that sugar, sucrose, is also 50% fructose and 50% glucose, and that high fructose corn syrup was just another version of sugar. And so we kind of knew that sugar was bad. There was this general sense that you should eat less of it, and Heart as a Sugar Association tried to convince us otherwise. And sugar in the 1970s was being portrayed as a kind of noxious, generally noxious part of the diet you didn't need. And then high fructose corn syrup comes in right around the time we start doing food labeling. And, you know, when you're on the food labels, the ingredients have to go in the proportion of the ingredient in the food. So all these foods like, you know, soba iced teas, I don't know if soba's still around because I stopped drinking them, you know, health foods, ginkgo biloba and all this stuff in it, and yet the ingredients are basically sugar and water. But we didn't know high fructose corn syrup was sugar. People didn't start realizing that until, and the corn refiners went out of their way to portray it as something other than sugar. And the joke is now that they're getting blamed for the obesity epidemic, they're going out of their way to say, no, it's sugar. It's no worse than sugar. Anyway, so that's what I'm saying that happened. The exercise thing, exercise is an effect of getting, I mean, sedentary behavior is an effect of getting fat. It's not a cause of getting fat. You got to wait. You can talk to me afterwards.
So then what about the fruit? Because you mentioned in an earlier slide that, yeah, fruit's okay.
Well, they thought fruit was okay.
What's your sense about that?
Depends on the person.
Okay.
You know, it depends. Some people can eat it, some people can't. And how much depends on the person. You know, like if you look at the low-carb diet doctors, they'll go for blueberries because they have a low glycemic index and very, you know, a low fructose content. They're not that sweet. But also part, another way to look at this is the whole paleo diet movement. It's basically eat the foods we evolved to eat. And we didn't evolve to eat refined carbs and easily digestible starches and certainly not, you know, sugar in the form, you know, honey a little bit, but that was it and whatever you found in fruit. But even the fruits we evolved to eat were very different than the fruits that exist today. You know, I mean, we've spent a long time breeding apples to be juicier and sweeter and peaches to be juicier and sweeter. And they, when they were available, they were only available a very short time of the year. So most of the year you weren't eating fruit. Unless you lived in, you know, I mean, people believe in this, like to go back to when we were primates and lived in the jungle, you know, in the trees and lived on fruit, but that's 2.5 million years ago. You know, there's a long time in between. So the idea is, you know, and this is where I kind of differ from the paleo people, although they set, but, you know, some people can tolerate it, some people can't. Back there, the smartest guy in the field, the guy who helped me put this together, was a DuPont physician named Alfred Pennington, who started in the late 1940s, started treating DuPont executives, overweight DuPont executives, with an all-meat diet. And he did it because they couldn't get these people to lose weight any other way, and they were afraid they were all going to die hard. They tried low-calorie diets. They tried exercise. Nothing worked. There was a New York doctor named Blake Donaldson who had been treating people with basically all meat three meals a day and a little bit of green vegetables. And people lost weight effortlessly. Pennington tried it at DuPont. He lost weight effortlessly, put the DuPont executives on it. They lost weight. And some of them, He said you could eat as much as you want. Don't worry about it. Just don't eat carbs. And some of them tried to prove he was wrong. You know, some of them said, oh, I can eat as much as I want, so I'm going to pig out on meat. And they did, and they still lost weight. And Pennington said, this is weird. Here I believe it's all about calories, but these people are eating 4,000, 5,000 calories a day and losing weight. What's going on? And it was Pennington, because it was 1948, who went back to the pre-war literature, because it was, you know, and I just followed his references back in time. And it was, Pennington should have been the Einstein of the field. He got one thing wrong because he didn't know that type 2 diabetics had high insulin levels, because nobody knew that in 1948. Had he known it, he would have cracked the whole thing. And of course, he got run out of medicine 10 years later for pushing high-carb or low-carb diets. But the point is, he had one patient. He said he had an obese DuPont executive who lost 50 pounds effortlessly. If he had one apple a day, his weight loss stopped. You know, and this was a footnote in a paper. But this was in a period like 1951 when he had no reason to do anything but report accurately his clinical observations. And if that's true, then obese people who want to be lean can't eat fruit, or some of them can't, you know? And I just know that this idea of a blanket, pass fruits and vegetables, there's no studies behind. It's just this sort of Adam and Eve thing. And then what we have, you know, instead of what we evolved to eat, it's what, you know, Adam and Eve ate, however, 4,000 years ago. It could work for some people, but it's a blanket recommendation. I think it's a huge mistake.